When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is A Word, a podcast from Slate. I'm your host, Jason Johnson. This week, a Minnesota jury declared what many of us have said from the start. Ex-cop Derek Chauvin is a murderer.
We said, God, we need justice.
Yeah.
We need it now. And he answered.
Yeah.
But can a conviction for killing George Floyd lead to justice for other killer cops? More coming up on A Word with me, Jason Johnson. Stay with us. Welcome to A Word, a podcast about race and politics and everything else. I'm your host, Jason Johnson. I can't breathe. That cry from George Floyd still has resonance for so many Black Americans, even if the conviction in the Derek Chauvin trial brought some relief. Here's Terrence Floyd talking about his brother and the case after the verdict.
I will salute him at every day of my life. I will salute him. Because he showed me how to be strong. He showed me how to be respectful. He showed me how to speak my mind. I'm going to miss him. But now I know he's in history.
Yay.
What a day to be a Floyd, man.
For many Americans, the conviction of Derek Chauvin marked a milestone in the fight for police reform. But the history of police violence against Black people is long. And while the arc of history may lean towards justice, the arc of policing in America still leans towards people being on our necks for 9.5 minutes and it requiring a year's worth of protest to even get a conviction. Which begs the question, how did we get here? And can the verdict after George Floyd's death be a true turning point for American policing and its relationship with Black America? Professor James D. Ward has spent his career studying these issues. He's the author of the book, Policing and Race in America, Economic, Political, and Social Dynamics. He's also the interim director of the Master of Public Policy Program and visiting professor at Cal Poly. And he joins us now. Welcome to A Word.
Thank you. Good to be here.
When you heard that Derek Chauvin was found guilty on all charges in the death of George Floyd, what was your immediate reaction? Like, were you relieved, surprised? Did you feel something else?
Well, I felt that it was a right decision. I was relieved only from the standpoint that I felt that it is a beginning. But if you look at the history of policing and race in this country, and at the history of police officers not being held accountable for their actions, it is not something that's going to bring about justice in the broader sense. It is something that gives a glimmer of hope, but I do not see it as justice from the standpoint of the wider injustice that has been done so far. A lot still needs to be done.
And Professor, I want to dig into this a bit because I didn't feel any hope at all. I wasn't happy. I wasn't pleased because to me, this seemed like just a makeup call. How did that bring you hope? It just reminded me of the ridiculous threshold required for a Black person to even get a nominal scintilla of justice in this country.
What happened in Minnesota as far as the conviction of this one police officer, it's not something that we can automatically say, well, it's going to happen now in every other state and every other jurisdiction. That's not the case. For that reason, I said that it is a glimmer of hope from the standpoint that it can be done if people do what's right. If law enforcement officials, if public officials, if society says this is wrong. But I think it's going to take a change in the American culture. It's going to take a change as far as how the American culture sees race. And law enforcement is simply an extension of the great American culture. So law enforcement does not operate in a vacuum until the American culture changes as far as implicit bias, as far as how it sees African-Americans and other people of color. Until that changes, you're not going to have any kind of transformational change within the police department or within law enforcement.
So it's interesting you mentioned unconscious bias. So Monday, the presiding judge, Peter Cahill, instructed the jury to consider the role of unconscious bias in their deliberations. Here's his clip.
Each of you have different backgrounds.
and will be viewing this case in light of your own insights, assumptions, and biases. Listening to different perspectives may help you to better identify the possible effects these hidden biases may have on decision making. And four, resist jumping to conclusions based on personal likes or dislikes, generalizations, gut feelings, prejudices, sympathies, stereotypes, or unconscious biases.
How rare is it for judges or prosecutors during the trial to tell the jury to think about unconscious bias? Is that common, or is that something new and something we should expect down the road in this country?
It's something that is very widely researched. It's something that's been very well shown that implicit bias exists. And so when I was talking about a cultural change as far as how society views race and how that has to extend to law enforcement as, I guess you could say, an extension of society, that includes implicit bias or unconscious bias. We have to get to the point in this nation where it doesn't matter what color a person is, what background a person is. Law enforcement has to come to the point where it applies its training equally across different neighborhoods, across different communities, regardless of socioeconomic status, regardless of racial, ethnic makeup of that community. And the same type of public safety, the same type of serve and protect mentality that law enforcement provides in middle-class white neighborhoods, it can provide in urban communities of color.
All too often, we have to look at this in the view of how some white Americans look at this issue. And you said that you know white conservatives, even Trump voters, who thought that Chauvin was guilty. Are you concerned that, like, white Americans across the spectrum are going to say, see, the system works, the system works. He ended up being convicted, and not be interested in long-term police reform?
Yes. I think it's very similar to when Barack Obama was elected president in 2008. Many people said, well, now we have a black president, so we don't have racism anymore. And I think that I can see that in a very similar situation.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, more on the future of policing after the Chauvin verdict. This is A Word with Jason Johnson. Stay tuned.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You're listening to A Word with Jason Johnson. Today we're talking about the future of policing with Professor James Ward. This is a big thing for me. And I came to this conclusion last summer after seeing what was happening and researching it. I'm in favor of abolishing policing as we know it. I don't think it works. I don't think that we can train people out of what's going on. From your perspective, do you think that is possible? And from a theoretical standpoint, what would abolishing police and rebuilding a public safety system, because it's not like people don't still need protection, but what would abolishing the police look like? And do you think that's even possible?
I do believe that the language that's used as far as abolishing the police, defunding the police, are things that may not go over well with certain elements on the right wing. However, I do agree with you that because of the culture that exists within American society, because of the culture that exists within law enforcement, that it does need to be cut down and then allowed to be built back up.
So this is my theory on how you do it, right? You take a look at your average police department, you say, all right, what percentage of time are you making traffic stops? What percentage of the time are you dealing with domestic disputes? What percentage of the time are you actually preventing violent crime? What percentage of the time are you hanging out at local high schools? And you look at what police are actually doing, and then you actually recreate forces that are specifically designed to handle those issues. Like, I don't need an armed cop showing up at every single traffic stop.
I think the whole fact that police officers have guns, they have a badge, they're empowered by that, allows them to use excessive force. And it allows them to kill people and get away with it because of qualified immunity and other protections. there are certain instances where police officers should not be involved. And so defunding the police, abolishing the police, or whatever term you want to use to make it more palatable to the American public, I think is the way to go.
What in your own personal experience led you to focus on race and policing? Like, something always drives us. What drove you to look at race and policing?
Well, when I was a young assistant professor, I was stopped by a police officer around 11 o'clock at night. I had just finished teaching a class and had gone for a jog, had on running shorts and sweaty t-shirt. And I'm thinking, well, there's something wrong, must be wrong with my car. Maybe there's a tail light out or something. So I pulled over, waiting for the police officer to come and tell me what's wrong with my car. And I noticed I was staring down the barrel of a gun. Ordered for my car at gunpoint, just treated like a common thug. And so I did not get a ticket once he found out that I was didn't have a criminal record. That was my first encounter with policing and race. It all goes back to implicit bias. You know, Martin Luther King said a long time ago that a law, if you change the law, it cannot make a man love me, but it can keep him from lynching me. And I think that it gets to changing the laws to the point where police officers know that they cannot engage in certain types of behavior and go unpunished. It gets back to the laws, because you cannot pass laws that will sudden, you know, make people say, well, we're not going to be racist anymore. We're not going to treat people badly because of the color of their skin. But you can pass laws that make them say, well, we're not going to treat people badly. If I'm a law enforcement, I'm not going to engage in this the kind of force that could lead to death, because I can be punished for it. I will be punished for it. And I think that the emphasis has to be on, I guess, changing the behavior from the standpoint of the penalties that these law enforcement officials know they will face if they continue to engage in this type of behavior. If you can continue to convict these law enforcement officials, these police officers, if it's aggravated, uncalled for, give them the death penalty. That's how you change the behavior. That's how you make a law that keeps police officers from shooting and killing unarmed black suspects.
You know, which is an interesting theory, because, again, most activists would tell you that the death penalty is not a deterrent for violent crime. So why would the fear of the death penalty have any greater impact on a police officer than it would on the average person who's trying to carjack it?
Because with law enforcement, it's a profession. And I think that they know if they want to advance in the profession, if they want a future in this profession, when they go through training, they will become very familiar with the fact that certain police officers have gone to jail, have been sentenced to death for these types of actions. And I think that when you look at it from the standpoint of a law enforcement profession, then you begin to change the culture. That's how you change the culture within that profession.
I think about police, military police officers, and the rate of death in interactions with military police officers, it's hard to get access to this information, but it is significantly lower than what we have amongst regular private citizens. And I've always thought that's because, you know, if you are a military officer and you get a call about a domestic dispute on base, that is the most high-risk situation you could be in, right? Because you know you're dealing with a trained soldier, at least you know they might be armed, and yet we don't hear about military police officers often having to use deadly force. And I think the core of that is because they see that other person as a fellow soldier, and they're going to do whatever it is that they can to try to de-escalate the situation and bring that person in before taking their life. That's not how your average white cop sees your average black person. They don't see them as sharing a similar bond. So when you talk about how we need to make a cultural change, how the heck are we going to do that? Is that a Joe Biden speech? Is that electing a lot more black people to office? How are we going to make that cultural change?
Well, you're talking about the culture that exists within the military, and that same culture that exists within the military does not exist in the civilian law enforcement. If civilian law enforcement were to see every suspect, black, white, Asian, regardless of race, as an equal, as this person could be my relative, this person could be my brother, this person could be my sister, they don't see that. They see that black person or that person of color as a threat. If that way of operating in the military police could be transferred to civilian police, that would make a difference.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll focus on how the Chauvin verdict could change the politics of police reform. This is A Word with Jason Johnson. Stay tuned. I've got a special message for our listeners in Canada. It's about a show that I think you should listen to.
Canada Land. Every week, Canada Land's journalists bring you news and conversations that honestly can be hard to find these days. With rigorous reporting and thoughtful analysis, their episodes bring you into the most important conversations from across the country. From a radical form of reconciliation emerging in Saskatchewan to in-depth debates and gun rights and the rise of fascism, Canada Land stories will surprise you and make you think. Try Canada Land today and find out why Canadian news doesn't have to sound like Canadian news. Search Canada Land in your podcast app.
You're listening to A Word with Jason Johnson. Today we're talking about the Chauvin conviction and the future of police reform with Professor James Ward. The George Floyd Policing Act is something that lots of politicians have talked about and discussed. We're going to play a segment of Joe Biden and Vice President Harris talking about the George Floyd Policing Act.
George Floyd was murdered almost a year ago. There's meaningful police reform legislation in his name. You just heard the vice president speak of it. She helped write it. Legislation to tackle systemic misconduct in police departments, to restore trust between law enforcement and the people they're entrusted to serve and protect. But it shouldn't take a whole year to get this done.
This bill is part of George Floyd's legacy. The president and I will continue to urge the Senate to pass this legislation, not as a panacea for every problem, but as a start.
After just hearing that, Professor Ward, do you think the George Floyd Policing Act would save you from getting pulled over by a racist cop or me from getting pulled over by a racist cop? Because I got to be honest, when I read the legislation, it all sounds like ways to potentially get justice after that harassment, but nothing is preventative.
All these things are designed to change behavior in the long run, but immediately I think that we will not see sudden change even with the legislation, but I think it would be good in the long run.
Even though Chauvin was convicted, lots of activists will say that every step of this was a fight. Are we any closer to a time when the justice system will actually hold police accountable? And what are the actual numbers of police who ever get held accountable like this? Like, I'm under the impression that not only was Chauvin the result of a year's worth of international attention, but this probably only happens once in a blue moon.
Well, very few police officers are held accountable for their actions regarding force. And if we get to the point where they're held accountable more often, it's going to have to come from things like getting rid of qualified immunity, getting rid of, you know, these things such as statute of limitations in regards to how long a suspect has to bring suit against a officer or a law enforcement agency. So I think that the legislation in the George Floyd Act would help bring us to that point. But again, it's in the long term. It's not going to be immediate. I think once you have more and more police officers convicted, and if it's willful, intentional, aggravated murder, they should get the death penalty. I think only then will you see a sea change. Now, I want to say that I do believe that the majority of law enforcement officials are very honorable people, but they're the bad apples that are the minority. And it's the bad apples that are giving the majority a bad reputation.
Professor James Ward is the author of Policing and Race in America, Economic, Political, and Social Dynamics. Thank you so much, Professor Ward.
You're welcome.
And that's A Word for this week. If you're enjoying A Word, please subscribe, rate, and review. Did you know you could be listening to this show ad-free? All it takes is a Slate Plus membership. It's just $1 for the first month, and it also helps us keep making our podcast. Sign up now at slate.com/awordplus. The show's email is award@slate.com. This episode was produced by Ayana Angel and Jasmine Ellis. Asha Saluja is the managing producer of podcasts at Slate. Gabriel Roth is Slate's editorial director for audio. Alicia Montgomery is the executive producer of podcasts at Slate. June Thomas is senior managing producer of the Slate Podcast Network. Our theme music was produced by Don Will. I'm Jason Johnson. Tune in next week for A Word.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.